situational awareness. In this case, this allowed Farmington to not fight, flight, or freeze. Instead, he held it together until he fell through the dirty air and into a cleaner pocket below. Then my wings started to pressurize, and I turned my attention to JT's shoe, and we were off. Yup, they were off, and heading straight for Suicide Corner. In Switzerland, the team trained by proximity flying vertical cliffs roughly the size of the Willis Tower. They had a pretty good idea of what it felt like to fly in formation down a structure that size, but what they never found was a turn as tight as Suicide Corner. There was no way to prepare for it, says Holmes. It was a total unknown. And it did not disappoint. Going round Suicide Corner felt like I was making a really sharp turn in a jet airplane, says Farmington. Except there was no airplane. The power, speed, and pressure were the same, but there was no separation, no fuselage, no cockpit between myself and those forces. Out of that turn and into another, this one merely 90 degrees. By that point, DeVore was so deep into the zone, he felt like someone else was flying his body. I was just listening to the voice, he says, taking directions. This was a 90-degree turn at 150 miles per hour. And my experience was this voice in my head saying, oh look, you're turning again. Deployment was the next concern. They were using low-profile base rigs with canopies extending 225 feet square. Normally, because of these space requirements, formation flyers separate before deployment. For similar reasons, they prefer large landing zones. Neither was in the offing here. There were buildings all over the place, explains Holmes. No outs, places to ditch in times of trouble. And we didn't have 360 degrees to work with. I tried to go long and low. John pulled early, and Mike and Andy had to make do with what was left in the middle. Life and death would be measured in millimeters and milliseconds. The entire team would have to pull in short succession, one right after another. And within a 2-second window. Worse, because no one knew exactly which direction they would be facing when those chutes opened, they would each immediately have to grab their steering toggles, survey the scenery, and yank. If they had failed to notice something and turned the wrong direction? When my canopy opened, continues DeVore, there were guys floating 4 feet away from me. Without flow, none of this would have been possible. The pattern recognition and information chunking that took place in Switzerland would not have led to instinctive behavior in Chicago. Muscle reaction times would have been slower. Intra-group trust, weaker. Neither the spotlight attention needed to know when to pull, nor the future prediction required to determine which direction to turn, would have been in the offing. Panic would have swamped the system, and Suicide Corner would have earned its namesake. Instead, the Air Force floated safely to the ground. It was the highlight of my career, says DeVore. It was our Super Bowl on the moon. What an unbelievable rush, adds Swanson. About this last part, there is no debate. Flow is a rush like no other. If you want grounds for comparison, consider the current use-abuse rates for mood-altering, mind-altering, and performance-enhancing drugs. In America, over 22% of the population has an illicit drug problem. 1 out of 10 take antidepressants. 26% of kids are on stimulants, purportedly for ADHD, anecdotally for performance enhancement. And prescription drugs? They've just surpassed car accidents as the number one cause of accidental death. Add this up, and you'll find a $1 trillion public health crisis. Now consider what these abused drugs do. The primary illicit drug of choice is marijuana that triggers the release of anandamide. Antidepressants are some combination of dopamine, norepinephrine, and serotonin. Tobacco and ADHD drugs affect dopamine and norepinephrine, and prescription drugs of abuse are opioids like OxyContin meaning they affect the endorphin system. In other words, Americans are literally killing themselves trying to achieve artificially the same sensations that flow produces naturally. Of course, as a perfect endogenous combination of these drugs, flow is also a major rush. But unlike the dead-end highs currently plaguing public health, flow doesn't sidetrack one's life. It revitalizes it. Flow is the rush of possibility, a product of radical neurochemical, neuroelectrical, and neuroanatomical function triggering whole-body transformation. As DeVore concludes, I really think we're the next stage in human evolution. Or, to put it another way, flow is the telephone booth where Clark Kent changes clothes, the place from where Superman emerges. 5. The Flow Shortcut. Dirtbags to Samurai. In our quest to map flow and see how it amps up performance, there is still one component missing: performance over time. Certainly, what we learned from meeting Laird Hamilton, Danny Way, Dean Potter, and the Red Bull Air Force is that flow is the secret to Superman. Yet the Millennium Wave and Great Wall Mega Ramp were deeds over and done in seconds. The Willis Tower jump lasted less than 2 minutes. Potter's climbing trip through Patagonia almost a month. But a month is not a year, is not a career. The question here isn't about how flow helps these athletes do the impossible once. It's about them doing the impossible over and over and over again. It's about long-term mastery, not short-term success, and a question most certainly raised by the ascension of Shane McConkie. By almost any measure, McConkie did not follow the standard path toward mastery. Consider the trilogy of his most famous naked spread eagles. On this list, the Colorado backcountry cliff huck described earlier in this audiobook ranks third. Second place, meanwhile, clearly belongs to the Palisades. Located a short hike away from the top of Squaw Valley's Siberia Chair, the Palisades are one of skiing's most iconic proving grounds, a nasty series of rocky faces, intense steeps, tiny chutes, and little mercy. Dropping into some of the Palisade chutes is as abrupt as dropping a quarter into a payphone, explains the website Tahotopia. Lose it in process, and the rest of the ride is like being in a wave tank in physics class. You end up feeling like the Tin Man after a good thrashing by the flying monkeys. Even when everything goes right on the Palisades, things can go wrong. In 1975, during the filming of the cult classic ski flick Daydreams, Greg Beck aired 100 feet off a cliff on the Palisades, now known as Beck's Rock, nailed the landing perfectly, and still knocked himself out cold. A few yards away from Beck's Rock sits Extra Chute, where a 50-foot drop gives way to a 55-degree landing. In 1995, Shane McConkie was filming atop the Palisades with ski filmmaker and close friend Scott Gaffney. He had been throwing crazy backflips down Extra Chute all morning when a stranger approached and introduced himself as a representative for a new energy bar company, Naked Energy. The guy wanted a promotional photograph, so he offered McConkie $100 to jump the cliff nude. Back then, McConkie was both a nationally ranked mogul skier and the U.S. extreme skiing champion. But neither title came with paychecks worth a damn. He was still bussing tables to make ends meet. So yeah, off came the clothes and off he went, throwing the second most famous naked spread eagle in history, smack down the center of Extra Chute. The number one Shane McConkie naked spread eagle took place a few years earlier. By then, McConkie had graduated from Burke Ski Academy in Vermont with some exceptional racing skills and dreams of becoming the next Ingmar Stenmark. Those plans were nixed when he was tossed off the U.S. ski team for being too small. Afterward, he moved to Vail and was making ends meet by delivering pizzas and trying his hand at professional mogul skiing. He did pretty well on the tour, winning his first event in 1993. But not long after, at a Vail bump-off, McConkie fell early on his first run. Already eliminated from competition, he decided to celebrate by tossing a backflip off the final booter. "The crowd went nuts," wrote Rob Story in Skiing magazine. "Ski Patrol did too. They kicked him off the hill, since inverted aerials were illegal at that sphincter-puckered time." McConkie, of course, did not take this sitting down, or fully clothed. He snuck back onto the mountain, got back to the starting gate, stripped to the buff, streaked the race course, and, of course, threw a series of naked spread eagles along the way, the most infamous in the history of skiing. Vail, in their wisdom, banned him for life. McConkie was fine with that. He moved to Squaw Valley and continued on his quest to have more fun than anyone, ever. The stories are endless. McConkie threw backflips on monoskis, moonwalked on snowblades, and invented the now legendary ski film movie character Saucer Boy, a Jack Daniels swilling, gear-laden, extreme, well, saucer rider. Free skiing pioneer Mike Douglas once described what it was like to room with the superstar. "Every morning he'd be the first up and wake me up with, 'Wakey, wakey, hands off Snakey.' Then he'd proceed to poison the room with his farts. Then he would clog the toilet with a massive coiler that he'd be really proud of, followed by half a roll of toilet paper. Then he would show off all the most disgusting things he could find on the internet. If we were lucky, we'd go skiing or something. If we weren't, the process would just repeat all day long." That said, when it came time to go skiing, few could equal McConkie's prowess. His skills on the snow. Well, in one of Steve Winter's films, Ingrid Backstrom, herself one of the greatest skiers in the world, spoke for many when she said, "Pretty much it's always a bad idea to try to do something Shane can do." To this day, skiers use the phrase McConkie turn to refer to a giant high-speed power carve, usually made in some nosebleed steep, rock-strewn, cliff-laden, downright foreboding spot that, through the radically transformative capacity of a McConkie turn, had suddenly become a playground. Yet this does raise one additional issue. How does an undersized, washed-up racer with a penchant for practical jokes become the person that ski writer Leslie Anthony once fittingly described as the ski world's first Superman? In 1995, Shane McConkie was bussing tables and skiing naked for extra cash. Less than a decade later, he was a legend. But against what odds? By the time McConkie's star really began to rise, he'd already abandoned the traditional structures of athletic excellence. He was no longer a student at Burke Academy, had been tossed out of professional ski racing, and quit the pro mogul game. Gone were all the trappings of institutionalized mastery. No more world-class coaches, world-class assistant coaches, video playback reviews, dried land skill drills, team nutritionists planning his meals, team chefs cooking his meals, or team techs tuning his gear. McConkie had jettisoned the whole deal. Yet, somehow, climbed to far greater heights on his own. This same puzzle surrounds most of the early action and adventure sports stars. Before the X Games came along, these guys were ski bums and surf burnouts, and for good reason. The party never stopped. Forget about drug testing. Drug taking was almost mandatory. And the closest most got to a meal designed by a team nutritionist was a Cliff Bar. Yet in less than two decades, these same rebel misfits would push the boundary of human performance to astounding heights. Hell, by the time McConkie was done, his chosen sport was barely recognizable as the same game. Alaska is the wild frontier, skiing's ultimate proving ground. In 1990, when extreme skiing pioneer Doug Coombs made the first descent of Python Peak, it was a very big deal, considered the first serious descent of the era. In total, Coombs made hundreds of turns down this 50-degree Chugach beast because, of course, his survival was at stake. 50 degrees is damn steep. Standing straight up, Coombs could reach out and tickle the slope. No wonder he made hundreds of turns. Turns are what give skiers control. Well, 8 years later, McConkie would repeat the feat. Only this time, he straight-lined Python, making exactly zero turns from top to bottom and hitting speeds over 60 miles per hour along the way. Of course, this is only one example. In the past few decades, the bounds of the possible have been pushed farther and faster than ever before in history. Yet the folks doing the pushing were never anyone's ideal candidates for the job. To say this community has exceeded expectations would be a considerable understatement. These folks started out dirtbags and ended up samurai. How exactly did that happen? Mothers, musicians, and marshmallows. Over the past century, the science of expert performance has gotten rigorous and codified. Thousands and thousands of experiments have been run. Plenty of conclusions reached. Three dominate. Call them mothers, musicians, and marshmallows. This famed trilogy, details in a moment, represent our best ideas about the path to mastery. Yet there's a wrench in these works. Most action and adventure athletes took a radically different path. These athletes haven't just redefined the limits of human potential. They've redefined those limits by doing the opposite of what the experts say they should have done. It's peculiar, all right. Their stratospheric success suggests that we may have completely misjudged the path toward stratospheric success. In fact, it suggests something far more radical, that if we really want to be our best, we don't just have to rethink the path toward mastery. We need to reconsider the way we live our lives. But first, the mothers. In the early 1980s, University of Chicago educational psychologist Benjamin Bloom launched the Talent Project, one of the larger and more thorough retrospective studies of expert performance ever undertaken. The project examined the lives of 120 people, all under the age of 35, all of whom had demonstrated the highest levels of accomplishment in one of six fields: swimming, tennis, sculpture, piano, mathematics, and research neuroscience. That is, two artistic fields, two psychomotor, two cognitive. The question at the center of the study was, where does prodigious talent come from? Special individuals or special circumstances? Before the study began, Bloom was convinced that talent was innate, and what we call expertise, mastery, is the result of talented individuals identified early, then encouraged to blossom. Afterward, though, the data told a different story. Few of Bloom's research subjects showed any great promise as children. No Mozart concertos before the age of 3. No solving for pi from the crib. Instead, the one commonality was encouragement. A lot of encouragement. In each case, there was a parent or close relative who rewarded any display of talent and ignored or punished the opposite. Prodigies, it seemed, were made, not born. As Bloom later told reporters, "We were looking for exceptional kids, but what we found were exceptional conditions." This was a cornerstone finding, replicated and expanded and potent. The idea settled an uneasy corner of the nature-nurture debate. It democratized expertise. Provided the right environment and the proper encouragement, it meant that everyone had a shot at perfection. It meant there were no chosen few. But many of the athletes involved in action and adventure sports came up the hard way. The wrong environment. Little encouragement. A lot of us were from broken homes, skateboard pioneer Dwayne Peters once told the LA Times. We were freaks and misfits. And if home life wasn't rosy, the outside world was even less supportive. 25 years ago, skateboarding was a crime. Snowboarding was banned at most resorts, and surfing, to quote the always relevant Point Break, was for little rubber people who don't shave yet. Certainly, there are plenty of action and adventure athletes who came from incredibly supportive backgrounds. Bloom wasn't wrong. Mothers matter. But too many of these super athletes came up sideways, backward, and feral for this to be the single deciding factor. Something else is going on, and that something else is where the musicians come into play. In the early 1990s, Florida State psychologist Anders Ericsson performed one of the more famous studies of expertise in recent history. By surveying elite violinists at Berlin's Academy of Music, a.k.a. musicians, Ericsson found that while one's early environment was helpful, what truly distinguished excellent players from good players from average players was hours of practice. By the time they were 20 years old, expert violinists had put in 10,000 hours of deliberate, well-structured practice. The others had not. As Malcolm Gladwell famously explained in Outliers, the research suggests that once a musician has enough ability to get into a top music school, the thing that distinguishes one performer from another is how hard he or she works. That's it. And what's more, the people at the top don't work just harder or even much harder than everyone else. They work much, much harder. But another wrench. If 10,000 hours of deliberate, well-structured practice is the secret sauce, consider the difference between Erickson's definition of the term. This type of practice is focused, programmatic, carried out over extended periods of time, guided by conscious performance monitoring, evaluated by analyses of level of expertise reached, identification of errors, and procedures directed at eliminating those errors. And Shane McConkie's goals while skiing. What I love to do on the hill is find an interesting way to do something fun. Or, for that matter, consider his chosen sport. If you remember the 1980s, you probably weren't skiing, was a once popular saying whose sentiment still rings true. But it's not exactly the ideal backdrop for deliberate, well-structured practice. Put differently, deliberate, well-structured practice is a rigorous, compliance-based approach to mastery. It means you crawl before you walk. It doesn't mean Laird Hamilton surfing Pipeline at age 4, or Danny Way in the deep end of the pool at the Del Mar Skate Ranch by 7. In broader terms, deliberate practice is also how we train genius these days. It's factory athletics. It's Kuhn math tutoring, Baby Einstein, Suzuki violin, et al. But it's also the world McConkie walked away from that naked day at Vail. He turned his back on the factory, yet somehow still went on to become Superman. Finally, the trouble with marshmallows. In 1972, Stanford psychologist Walter Mischel performed a fairly straightforward study in delayed gratification. He offered 4-year-old children a marshmallow. Either the kids could eat it immediately, or, if they waited for him to return from running a short errand, they would get 2 marshmallows as a reward. Most kids couldn't wait. They ate the marshmallow the moment Mischel left the room. Yet a small percentage could resist temptation, and, over time, this turned out to be a big deal. When interviewed 14 years later, the kids who could wait were more self-confident, hard-working, and self-reliant. They could handle stress better and could handle tests better. Those who resisted at 4 ended up scoring 210 points higher on their SATs at 16. This may not sound like that much, but as fellow Stanford psychologist Philip Zimbardo explains, that is as large as the average difference recorded between the abilities of economically advantaged and disadvantaged children. It is larger than the difference between the abilities of children from families whose parents have graduate degrees and children whose parents did not finish high school. The ability to delay gratification at 4 is twice as good a predictor of later SAT scores as IQ. Poor impulse control is also a better predictor of juvenile delinquency than IQ. But there's another issue. According to psychologists, by definition, action and adventure athletes are sensation seekers. They're impulsive pleasure junkies. Delayed gratification is not their game. Hell, in a 2009 Outside magazine profile of Shane McConkie, journalist Tim Sohn wrote, "Riding in a backpack as his mother skied, a 3-year-old McConkie would shake the pack support bars while making known what he wanted. Pow, mommy, pow! Or, bump, mommy, bump!" Seriously, does pow, mommy, pow sound like a kid who didn't eat the marshmallow? So what gives? How do a bunch of impulsive hedonists raised far from the storied incubators of athletic excellence end up rewriting the rulebook on human potential? The short answer, of course, is flow. The long answer is where Philip Zimbardo comes back into our story. The importance of time perspectives. It started with illness. When Philip Zimbardo was 5 years old, he got a bad case of whooping cough and a worse case of pneumonia. This was 1939, New York. Zimbardo's family was too poor for private care, so he was sent to the charity ward of the Willard Parker Hospital for Children with Contagious Diseases. In those days, before antibiotics, 63% of all children with whooping cough or double pneumonia did not recover. Many a friend Zimbardo made in that hospital died in that hospital. Zimbardo found that the only way he could stop himself from sinking into despair was imagination. He kept imagining better possible futures, and to considerable impact. After Zimbardo recovered and was released, he was shocked to realize he viewed his stay in the hospital as a positive one, the time in his life that he learned to be self-reliant. "From this experience," he later wrote, "I learned that the past can be psychologically remodeled to make heaven of hell." Other people learn the opposite lesson, storing and recalling only the worst of times. The horrors and sheer ugliness of the past they have experienced become a permanent filter through which they view all their current experiences. Zimbardo went on to become one of the most well-regarded psychologists of the 20th century, author of more than 50 books, and past president of the American Psychological Association. He taught at both Yale and Stanford, and was at the latter institution when Walter Mischel performed his famed marshmallow experiment. The results caught Zimbardo's attention, but not because he was interested in delayed gratification. Rather, because they seemed to confirm his childhood suspicions about time. Zimbardo noticed two competing time perspectives at work in Mischel's experiment. A time perspective is the technical name for the permanent filter Zimbardo described. It's essentially our attitude toward time. For example, in Mischel's experiment, the kids who ate the marshmallow immediately were present hedonists. They lived for the now and not the later. It wasn't that they were unable to delay gratification. It's that not delaying gratification, the downstream result of being a present hedonist, was their strategy for living. And this strategy has an upside. As individuals, presents are creative, spontaneous, open-minded, high-energy risk-takers who play sports, have hobbies, make friends easily, and find lovers often. Their lives are fun-filled and fast-paced. Unfortunately, this comes at a cost. While presents are often the life of the party, that's often the end of the line. Because they act without anticipating consequences, don't often learn from past failures, and are across the boards unable to resist temptation, attractions of the drugs and sex and rock and roll variety often derail their lives. A dominant present orientation has been correlated with mental health problems, juvenile delinquency, crime, and addictions. And when it comes to the long path toward mastery, with neither desire to plan nor long-term vision, presents have a difficult time accumulating anything close to 10,000 hours of practice, deliberate or otherwise. On the other hand, kids who didn't eat the marshmallow are future-oriented, thus able to resist temptation today for a chance at a greater reward tomorrow. Futures have much to recommend them. In dozens and dozens of studies, they outperform presents in most every category. They get better grades and more education, are healthier and more optimistic, make more money, solve problems more consistently, are more mindful of morality, and can make the best of failure. They are the movers and shakers in this world. Zimbardo writes, "While presents avoid work, futures consider work a source of special pleasure. For them, tomorrow's anticipated gains and losses fuel today's decisions and actions. Gratification delayed for greater reward is always a better bet for futures, who will trade a bird in the hand for a flock in the future. Unlike their present hedonistic peers who live in their bodies, the futures live in their minds, envisioning other selves, scenarios, rewards, and successes. The success of Western civilization in the past centuries can be traced to the prevalence of the future orientation of many populations." Obviously, futures are more likely to achieve the 10,000 hours needed for mastery. But here, too, are unintentional consequences. Futures burn out. They become stressed-out workaholics. Blood pressure goes up, bowels get irritable, heart attacks increase, sex lives disintegrate, marriages fail, children become burdens, friends become memories, and the whole house of cards comes crashing down. So common is this experience that UCLA psychologist Stephen Berglass has coined the term supernova burnout to describe the phenomenon. In other words, even when plans work out, futures place a dangerous bet. Too much delayed gratification can rob them of their motivation, which is the very thing that made them futures in the first place. After 3 decades of research, Zimbardo found that the healthiest, happiest, highest performers blend the best of both worlds. The optimal time perspective combines the energy, joy, and openness of presence with the strength, fortitude, and long-term vision of the futures. But how to produce this blended perspective is the more important question. Time perspective is possibly genetic, probably cultural, and definitely hard to shake. It is shaped by geography, religion, socioeconomic status, education, and a host of other powerful forces. It operates unconsciously and ubiquitously. But if optimal results require blending a present orientation and a future orientation, getting into flow is one of the most efficient mixing mechanisms at our disposal. Flow reorients presence toward the future, and futures toward the present, and both to considerable result. Presents are sensation-seeking pleasure junkies. Flow releases a bevy of enormously potent feel-good neurochemicals at once, arguably the most powerful cocktail the brain can produce. It's the very sensation seekers seek most. Psychologists describe flow as autotelic, from the Greek auto, self, and telos, goal. When something is autotelic, that is, produces the flow high, it is its own reward. No one has to drag a surfer out of bed for overhead tubes. No one has to motivate a snowboarder on a powder day. These activities are intrinsically motivating autotelic experiences done for their own sake. The high to end all highs. Yet the flow high is different from all other highs, meaning it does more than just motivate. For starters, flow doesn't just happen anywhere. As we'll explore in depth in part 2 of this audiobook, The state shows up most reliably when we're using our skills to the utmost. It requires challenge. While other hedonic pleasures, drugs, sex, gambling, make us feel good on their own, flow only shows up when we're pushing ourselves to higher and higher levels of performance. Because flow involves meeting challenges and developing skills, explains Csikszentmihalyi in Good Business, it leads to growth. It is an escape forward from current reality, whereas stimulants like drugs lead backward. This is a very important point. Flow carries within it delicious possibility. In the state, we are aligned with our core passion and, because of flow's incredible impact on performance, expressing that passion to our utmost. Under normal conditions, playing chess, writing a report, this is empowering. But as author and adventurer Rob Schulteis writes in his cult classic Bone Games, under life-threatening conditions, he's describing a flow state that occurred while mountaineering, it's utterly transformational. The person I became was the best possible version of myself, the person I should have been throughout my life. No regrets, no hesitation. There were no false moves left in me. I really believe I could have hit a mosquito in the eye with a pine needle at 30 paces. I couldn't miss because there was no such thing as a miss. It didn't matter whether I fell or not because I couldn't fall, any more than 2 + 2 = 3. When doing what we most love transforms us into the best possible version of ourselves, and that version hints at even greater future possibilities, the urge to explore those possibilities becomes feverish compulsion. Intrinsic motivation goes through the roof. Thus, flow becomes an alternative path to mastery, sans the misery. Forget 10,000 hours of delayed gratification. Flow junkies turn instant gratification into their North Star, putting in far more hours of practice time by gleefully harnessing their hedonic impulse. In other words, when it comes to time perspectives, flow allows presence to achieve future's results. On the other side of this coin, flow pulls futures into the present. Because there is no time in the zone, there's no way to worry about tomorrow. There's literally no tomorrow. Flow provides futures with blissful release from all that endless striving. And since the release is autotelic, futures who find themselves in flow don't need to find new ways to slog toward the future. The state is intrinsically motivating, so the slogging takes care of itself. For similar reasons, the flow path presents an alternative to the standard futures, mothers, marshmallows, musicians approach to mastery. For starters, mothers aren't required on the flow path. No one had to encourage McConkie to ski. Skiing produces flow, and flow is autotelic. It was all the motivation he required. The marshmallow experiment, meanwhile, highlights the power of willpower. If kids can't develop the inner strength to resist temptation, they can't master themselves, let alone anything else. This makes life tricky for action and adventure athletes who, by definition, are marshmallow-eating, sensation-seeking hedonists. Thrill and adventure-seeking is one of the four categories used by psychologists to delineate sensation-seekers. But once the sensation-seekers jump on the flow path, they don't need to delay gratification to achieve success. Gratification becomes their path to success. I'm doing what I love, explains McConkie. And if you're doing what you want to do all the time, then you're happy. You're not going to work every day wishing you were doing something else. I get up and go to work every day and I'm stoked. That does not suck. The lesson of the musicians, meanwhile, is that 10,000 hours of deliberate practice is the only sure way to acquire real expertise. But are we certain? A quick shorthand for learning is the more emotionally powerful an experience, the more chance the details of that experience get moved from short-term storage into long-term memory. Both flow and high-risk situations produce extremely powerful emotional experiences. As a result, says high-performance sports psychologist Michael Gervais, athletes in flow in death-facing situations likely gather more relevant data and code it more efficiently. Having these experiences frequently could significantly shorten the learning curve toward expertise. Already, this has been proven correct in less extreme circumstances. In 2007, South Korean researchers looking at e-learning, electronic games, web-based learning tools, and electronic tutoring, discovered a significant correlation between flow and positive learning attitudes and outcomes. In 2011, neuroscientists with the United States Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, found that military snipers trained in flow decreased the time it took to acquire their targets by a factor of 2.3. Similar research run with amateur, that is, non-military, snipers found that flow cut the time it took to teach novices to shoot like experts by 50%. This means that flow doesn't just provide a joyful, self-directed path toward mastery. It literally shortens the path. Seeing lines. When Philip Zimbardo said that the success of Western civilization has been based upon a future-orientated time perspective, he was describing the struggle now, salvation later hypothesis of the Protestant work ethic. This ethic is among the reasons the mothers, marshmallows, and musicians' ideas have become so wildly popular. They confirm what we already want to believe. We have traded the now for the later, and in collectively making this switch may have missed a vital point. It doesn't need to be so hard. With passion and play as the gateway to performance and possibility, we no longer have to mistrust ourselves. We can harness our hedonic impulse, using moments of spontaneous joy to shorten our path to mastery. Which, of course, is exactly what Shane McConkie did. You want more proof? Then let's turn back the clock to the mid-1990s, take a trip to Squaw Valley, California, and ride the Broken Arrow chairlift. Beneath us sits some of the steepest, strangest terrain on the mountain. It's Salvador Dali strange. The landscape appears, as author Dr. Rob Gaffney explains in Squallywood, his epic guide to Squaw's gnarliest lines, to have been made by wet sand passing through a closed fist. In the winter, when snow starts to pile up between these formations, all sorts of deadly possibilities appear. Tight chutes, boulder drops, big multi-stage cliffs. Among them is the line now known as Sacrifice, though calling it a line is being generous. A steep headwall funnels into a tiny chute that ends at a granite boulder that overhangs a snowfield that gives way to a series of medium-sized cliffs that funnel into a really big cliff at the bottom. Sacrifice isn't a ski run, it's a trip to the morgue. Shane McConkie wasn't so sure. He too had been eyeing Sacrifice for a while. Instead of rocks and death, he noticed that there was a tiny patch of snow above each cliff. So could he hop and pop and connect those dots? It was a tricky question. To make the entrance, he'd need speed, enough to suck up his legs and sail over that boulder. And then things got interesting. A hard left mid-air, land on a dime, immediately leap right, zigzag a 25-footer, then stomp the landing and straight line off the monster air. Finding an interesting way to do something fun was McConkie's modus operandi. Sacrifice was his kind of fun. Shane loved trying to find the hardest way down the mountain, says Scott Gaffney. It was almost a compulsion. Seek out impossible spots and dream up ways to navigate further. In that way, he was literally a visionary. He just saw things other people didn't. Some of this talent was inherited. Shane's father, Jim McConkie, was a legend in his own right. According to his official Canadian Ski Museum biography, McConk, as he was affectionately known, preferred what was then the strictly unconventional. His Jalandi jumping and acrobatics on skis were the precursors to freestyle aerials and the freestyle movement generally. He sought out and reveled in difficult conditions. Broken crust, ice, and the infamous mashed potatoes, in order to improve his skills. Thought to be nearly impossible to ski, he was the first to conquer the gullies at both Alta and Snowbird. Shane was born in British Columbia, and his parents divorced when he was 4. His mother, Glenn, relocated to Santa Cruz, California, with Shane in tow. The parting was bitter, and father and son rarely saw each other afterward. "They barely had a cup of coffee together before Shane was 30, continues Gaffney. But Shane idolized his father. He was a huge influence. Shane wanted to be just like him. In trying to be like his father, and possibly because sensation-seeking has a genetic component, Shane's perspective shifted. He started reading the mountain differently, seeing lines that others couldn't. He also started skiing those lines. Of course, this produced flow, which upped his performance, which made other lines possible. Once Shane decided a line was possible, says professional skier skydiver J.T. Holmes, one of McConkie's closest friends, he felt that it had to be done. But he also felt he was one of the best skiers in the world, so if anyone was going to do it, he should be the one. That was the way his mind worked. That was Shane being logical. In 1998, Shane's logic led him to sacrifice. He nailed the line perfectly. Scott Gaffney filmed it, viewable in Something About McConkie, and the hop-and-drop ski technique known as billy-goating was born. As billy-goating required new skills, it led Shane farther down the flow path, which led to even more skills, which opened up new possibilities, which drove him forward still. During his big mountain competition days, wrote Micah Abrams in one of that era's preeminent ski magazines, Freeze, McConkie would routinely point out lines that snaked through rock faces and across gut-churning cliffs to his fellow competitors. More often than not, he was met with blank stares or rolled eyes, to which he would respond empathically, "Dude, it's totally doable." Then he would go do it. And then he would win. Along these lines, Olympic gold medalist skier Johnny Mosley tells a story about the first time he went to British Columbia to film a ski movie with McConkie. In one particular scene, Shane skied a 13-stager where he lost his ski on one of the 20-foot cliffs in the middle of this exposed line. He snapped it back on and shredded the rest. It was at this point that I reconsidered my thoughts of getting into the business where Shane had made his name. And this is sort of where skydiving comes in. McConkie began tossing himself out of airplanes in 1995. By 1999, he'd become a proficient enough base jumper to begin considering his childhood dream. Reenacting the ski off a cliff and deploy a parachute to evade the bad guys scene from The Spy Who Loved Me. It took a few years to work out the technical details, but in 2003, he went bond off a 400-footer in Lover's Leap, California. Most people thought it was a stunt. McConkie claimed it was the way forward. Evolution. Progression. What was next? No one believed him. In 2004, he ski-based off the 13,025-foot Eiger in Switzerland. Then they started to believe him. For McConkie, ski base gave him a way to start seeing really different lines. He has a phrase for aesthetically enticing terrain that had forever been off-limits because of gargantuan cliffs at the run's end. Closeout lines. With ski base, these closeout lines were finally open for business. "My whole vision," he says, "is that there are these impossible lines that no one would ever ski because they end in death cliffs. With parachutes, you can ski them. Those lines are totally doable now." Ski base is definitely not the kind of result that shows up on the compliance-based path to mastery. McConkie did not spend his adult life trying to shave 4 seconds off his time in the giant slalom. Instead, he saw lines and pursued flow, and, as legendary skater Tony Hawk once told reporters, change the world. Shane brought everyone hope. It was like a new day, and what can we do with it? What are we going to explore? How far can we take this? So, how far can we take this? It's a good question, with the we being the most important part. Flow, as Csikszentmihalyi discovered, is ubiquitous. This means that all the superpowers detailed in this first section of the audiobook, the fluid brainwave control exhibited by Laird Hamilton, the deep relationship to the voice enjoyed by Dean Potter, the near-telepathic prowess of the Red Bull Air Force, and the accelerated path to mastery trod by Shane McConkie, are available to any and all. This is who we are and how we're wired. Flow is our birthright. But what do we do with that knowledge? As always, that part is up to us. Part 2. Flow Hacker Nation. Listen, there's a hell of a good universe next door. Let's go. E.E. Cummings. 6. Outer Flow. Doug Ammons and the Stikine. It was one of the most dangerous experiments ever run, and it was run in silence. Doug Ammons told no one ahead of time. The editor of several different science journals, Ammons did not tell his colleagues. He did not tell his wife, or his children, or his friends. Definitely not his friends. They would have told me I was committing suicide, recounts Ammons, that I was on the death trip. They wouldn't have understood. How could they understand? This wasn't about dissecting frogs, or sequencing DNA, or even splitting the atom. This was about actual transformation. Ammons wanted to transform himself into a drop of water. He was betting his life on the possibility. Ammons is a true polymath. He holds degrees in math, physics, and psychology, is a classical guitarist, black belt in karate, successful businessman, acclaimed author, respected philosopher, and, without question, one of the most revered kayakers in history. In 2000, Outside made a list of the 10 greatest adventurers since 1900, with their major criterion being their achievements permanently altered the landscape of adventure. Ammons is number 7. Whitewater-wise, his achievements include over 50 first descents, a sizable number of solo expeditions, and a few, more peculiar trips. On a number of occasions, Ammons has paddled Class 5, expert only, rivers, without a paddle, or hand paddling, as they call it. Many people think of hand paddling as a stunt, and solo paddling, especially on a big river, as suicide. To Ammons, as he explains in his book Whitewater Philosophy, both are a form of research. Perhaps the most beautiful experience in kayaking is flow. There isn't any other sport that demands such intimacy with nature, moving in harmony with the power and intricacy of the river. And whitewater kayaking is the preeminent flow sport. When you paddle, well, there is the feeling that you are pouring yourself right into and through the river, with no distractions at all. You can weave yourself right into the current. Soloing is the open door for understanding how close to the river you can be. Ammons's desire for river intimacy is rooted in an even bigger desire, the deep ache to participate in the fundamental components of creation, elemental powers, eons of time. Adventure sports form a modern Tao, he once told reporters, allowing us to take part in the very forces that sculpted and shaped the world around us. And it was this desire for primal participation that first drew Ammons to the wilds of Upper British Columbia, to one of the last great secrets, to the Grand Canyon of the Stikine. The Stikine has been described as one of the world's forgotten wonders, but it's unlikely to become a tourist attraction anytime soon. The weather is cold and gray on a good day, downright mean on a bad. The surrounding wilderness covers an area twice the size of France, with a human population numbering in the low thousands. Grizzly bears, meanwhile, are everywhere. Yet the wildlife and wildlands are just sideshow attractions. The canyon is the real show, a vast gorge carved by a ferocious torrent, some 60 miles of colossal Class 5-plus whitewater, 25 Holy Mother of God rapids, hundreds of smaller tortures, and a reputation as the Mount Everest of expedition kayaking. In his essay, A Brief History of the Stikine, Ammons agrees. This is not a normal river run, not even by the standards of highly experienced Class 5 kayakers. The rapids are dominated by compressional turbulence, incredibly large holes, closed-out features, and monstrous slabs of water that you stick to like flypaper as you try to make your moves. It's an ominous and spectacular canyon, over 1,000 feet deep, and in some places so narrow that a helicopter can barely slip through. You are exposed to rockfall while scouting and even in your boat. It isn't the Zambezi. There is no warmth in the glacial water or the typically blustery fall weather. The flow is between 8,000 and 20,000 CFS at low water, and levels can change as much as 10 feet in a day. Many sections are from 60 to over 120 feet per mile. And as any big water paddler knows, when you combine steep and narrow with lots of water, you're talking the real shit. Attempts are made at low water in the early fall, and there's the very real possibility of a freeze or snow, which has happened to two different teams. For 70% of the canyon, it is very difficult or utterly impossible to climb out, with vertical walls on both sides rising straight out of the river. If you do have to bail and climb out, as has happened to 8 teams, it is easy to get lost up on the plateau and entirely possible to get killed by the wildlife. This isn't California. It's the goddamned Canadian wilderness. It was paddler Rob Lesser who first spotted the Stikine on a trip up to Alaska. This was 1977. He chartered a plane for an overflight. The walls were so steep, the canyon so deep, there wasn't much to see. What he saw looked foreboding. Lesser labeled rapids, Killer Falls 1 and Killer 2 and the like. And he liked. 4 years later, Lesser returned with a team of exceptionally skilled kayakers and a helicopter for support. They managed about 60% of the canyon. One member of their team, John Wasson, nearly drowned along the way. They named the rapid after him, Wasson's Hole. They named another the Hole That Ate Chicago. It was just that kind of river. Lesser came back in 1985, this time with legendary boaters Bob McDougall and Lars Holbeck, and another helicopter. The chopper ferried supplies, abetted portages, and served as a security blanket should things go sideways. But there was no sideways. The trio pulled it off, completing a milestone first ascent down the hole of the Stikine. In 1989, Lesser and McDougall returned, with Doug Ammons as their third. This time, no helicopter. The team was attempting the first self-supported expedition through the canyon. It was a big bet. Without a chopper in tow, if they got into trouble, the closest help was easily a mountain range away. This being the Stikine, they quickly got into trouble. 7 miles into the trip was Entry Falls, the first of the river's major rapids. Doug McDougall went first, trying a conservative sneaker route around the boil. So much for conservative. He got swallowed, smashed, slammed, cartwheeled, washing machined, window shaded, and then, arguably the worst death trap a kayaker can encounter, pinned beneath an undercut rock. About to black out, McDougall saw a glimmer of light, clawed upward, got swept sideways, slapped a handhold, and, somehow, managed to propel himself into an eddy. His kayak was long gone. "When he was done puking water," recounts Emmons,